Why, PY?
Okay. Right, let's hear the question, Mr. Jeffrey.
Okay, mine is
around the slide relating to the vacancies. I'll have to look at my old documentation again. You spoke about positions vacant. I can't find it. But you spoke about vacancies due to being unable to find candidates, suitable candidates. And you mentioned particularly the director, Deputy Director General for Constitutional Development, and the CFO and the DDG Corporate Services. Now, on the report that you gave us, dated 23rd of July, you gave us a report of all the vacancies and what was being done to fill them. In those posts, you had DDG Constitutional Development waiting for the Minister's Office to provide a date for the interview. So, DDG Corporate Services panel approved and waiting availability of the panel members. And the CFO memo en route, interviews were conducted on the 8th of March, memo en route for cabinet approval. There's nothing there around, it will have to be advertised because people are not suitable.
And the question is from Mr. Stockbridge, to the other from.
Thank you very much. Chair, I still had quite a large portfolio that I had not dealt with, and we'll try and deal with them quite quickly. So just on the issue of statistics, the point that we were trying to make earlier is that there is a bigger issue on statistics, both whether you are looking from an MPA perspective, from our own perspective, from the judiciary, and we need to find a mechanism. We are working on that, but I don't think we're going to find a solution almost immediately in terms of how we get, because the methodology of how we gather the statistics, in my mind anyway, has not necessarily been agreed. So we get numbers and we interpret them whichever way. So that, I think, is the first challenge with statistics. But it's a consideration that between the Office of the Chief Justice, between ourselves as a department, Legal Aid South Africa, and MPA, we have to find a solution, and that's all I'm saying. And what we need to do is we need to find a solution a lot quicker. Now, with with case flow management processes shaping in the manner that they are, one of the outcomes of that is to then piggyback on that environment and say, let's start creating new statistics of going forward. And we can then try and go back and fix the problems. But there is a point at which we need to peg put our pegs on the ground and say, we start from here, we are building a new portfolio of statistics that we can all, that we can all understand and that we can all interpret in the same way. This is not just a Department of Justice problem. I think generally we are struggling as government with statistics. And for instance, we will try and deal with this when we talk about our program performance. Even when we report on international obligations, we do struggle in the same way as we're struggling as a department, not just as a Department of Justice. So it's a common problem, but it's a problem that, for instance, the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities has been entrusted with the responsibility to coordinate those statistics where we are reporting internationally. So even there, we will participate in the department going forward. So that's where I wish to leave it. So if the question that was asked, are we relying on NPA statistics specifically now? Indeed, we are relying on NPA statistics. But we find that even there, even their own statistics, there are still issues behind them, and so it's not an absolute relief and an absolute comfort, and that's the point I wanted to raise. But for now, because we have to run a business depending on some sort of information, we are then having to rely on NPA statistics. But in the department, we have unreliable as it might be, but we have the NOC tool that through which we have been collecting statistics. NOC. Konje, what is the NOC? National Operations Center, through which we collate statistics. So some of the slides is generated from that source. On the issue of the general court performance, we will take this issue up again tomorrow when we deal with program 2. Change of security infrastructure, one of the challenges you will see when we discuss the BRR report, and I think in part this morning it was beginning to be clearly articulated that it's not just the guarding contracts that are a problem, but also the infrastructure side of the contract are a problem. There, in terms of the targets, and I'm speaking from memory, but it is in the presentation, in terms of the targets, we had targets to put security infrastructure in 150 courts. We ended up having to revise the target downwards to 9 courts, I think. And in that, the reason why we did that was that the cost of security infrastructure, unfortunately, had grown monumentally. And so, indeed, the intention is because we can't provide guarding service in every court in the foreseeable future. In some instances, we have to rely on technology. In other instances, we will have to rely on where there is less risk. We probably will need to rely on technology. But these are choices that management is faced with going forward. And we'll come back once we have found the solution on that. Rates and taxes, I just wanted to clarify this. As an alternative to infrastructure, or if they're used in the same sentence. And I think it's a little bit unfortunate if we take a literal interpretation of that. What are we saying to National Treasury? And this, so I don't want this thing to be taken out of proportion and be understood to have said National Treasury says it's either it's construction and no payment of rates. National Treasury has not said that. What we are making a proposal to National Treasury for is that given the fact that we've experienced some challenges in terms of getting our tenders issued on time for construction, it means the money that we have been allocated for infrastructure, we aren't going to spend it by the end of the year, and we know that now. Now, in part, we want to be able to give back money to Treasury early enough so that Treasury can reallocate it because of some of the problems that are beyond our control at this point. But we are saying that as we do that, Treasury must also be told, and we've raised this issue with Treasury already, so it's not theoretical, to say given the fact that we have a huge backlog of rates and taxes, and I'll explain that because you were asking much later as this hub whether we are paying rates and taxes, and I'll come back to that, but let me finish this principle first. Given the fact that we have this huge backlog of rates and taxes, why don't, as a one-off mechanism to address all the backlogs related to rates and taxes, be given one-off window to correct this using the allocation from the infrastructure? So that is the principle my colleague was trying to articulate. Now, the next question that was related was, are municipalities being paid rates and taxes on behalf of the Department of Justice for the property that we are using? Our answer is as follows. And we'll be confirmed again tomorrow by a person who is a specialist in this area. But from a non-specialist perspective, what, in terms of our contractual arrangements between ourselves and Public Works, Public Works pays on a regular basis, let's call it even a month-on-month basis, whatever their cycle is, pay rates and taxes, and then they have to recover from us. Now, Honorable Member Swart was saying that, well, you are also owing other people intergovernmental obligations. This is one of them. This rates and taxes is one of them, because public works will then bill us, and then we will pay public works. But public works pays for municipalities, for all intents and purposes. Public works is the primary landlord. So they pay rates and taxes, they bill us, we then pay them later. And that's the point. So if municipalities have not been paid, it really is public works who ought to be able to pay that. And that's what I wanted to clarify. Now, there are billing issues that we are resolving. As I have said, we are now meeting with the DG and having myself and my team on a monthly basis to look at the infrastructure program. What can we fast-track? What can we do to correct what we believe is a crisis for us? But in addition to that, we are also talking about these issues of billing, correct billing, timely billing, so that we are able to pay them on time as well. So I just want to close this question.
So public works has to pay the full amount no matter what that amount is, right? And then if you, as you say, I think Mr. Johnson was saying that your budget goes up by 5%, but then sometimes the rate and taxes go up to 15%. Public works has to pay in any way, in any case. Then if you haven't got the money, then you owe public works, then is that correct? Okay.
That is absolutely correct. So this means that our bill with public works is increasing. So this is one area that we are trying to find a resolution for. So when we say once-off payment window for us to pay for rates and taxes, that's what we mean. Now, just to close up on, therefore, what will National Treasury say about that? They haven't given us a response specific to that request. But when Johan was talking about infrastructure, I really want to contextualize that. One of the fundamental issues of government that was resolved was that for us to grow the economy at the rate at which is required, we are going to have to focus on infrastructure. That is not in dispute. Now, of course, once a director of that magnitude comes out at the office where it comes out, we all must then shape up and try and deliver according to the requirements. The Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee has to ensure that all of those things happen, which means we must align to that. Now, if you contextualize that as the broader directive, and when you start, and Treasury has now, in keeping with the broader directive, allocated you a decent budget for infrastructure, to then take that money, and I think that's the point Johan was trying to say, and say, oh, there's this small matter of rates and taxes. It's not going to work that way. And that's the point. So it's, what I wanted to clarify, it's not Treasury saying no, but we are also conscious that Treasury, in giving us this money, was not only responding to our request, but we have a broader directive that we are moving infrastructure, and we are all proud of that, and that's the point that I wanted to clarify. Now, There was an issue of accruals that arose yesterday, but it arose again today that I really want to close up on as well. The accruals, this issue that we just discussed, creates a huge accrual for us. But there are other issues and even some other sorts of liabilities from an accounting perspective. But there are other issues of cash management that in part, for us not, maybe let me start by saying, the department clearly, our processes of being able to pay within 30 days are only starting to work now. But for a long time, as you had said, we had been paying around 90 days and sometimes longer, so we brought it down to 35 days and we're bringing it down, but which means For a very long time, we've been errant on that. So there is no dispute about that. But so there is the one aspect, which is the total inefficiency that of our own internal systems historically. But now we are addressing that. But there's another second issue related to that, which is, strictly speaking, cash flow management. And so the accruals, other than the inefficiencies of the system, have also resulted as a result of pure cash flow management. Had we paid everything on day last 31st of March, or whenever we closed our books, our system, our procurement system, twice last year in February and somewhere in March. Had we closed then and hit everybody, would definitely have been over. But and I think that's just the point I wanted to clarify, because it keeps coming up, and it's just a simple issue. It's management choice around cash management. Then the money is owed to departments. Oh God, I found the slide. Can you find me the slide? Money is owed to, in fact, I can speak to it. Money is owed by departments to the Department of Justice. The collection process is going very well. At the end of April 2012, we were owed 358,876 rand. But let me explain how that works. This is a revolving credit. It's not our vote. Just to clarify that. We have a fund, we have a pool of resources that we go and draw down from pay-based attorneys and pay the other side for the work, in other words, for lost cases and all of that, but also our state attorneys must settle whatever other bills they have from this account. It's an account, it's not a fund, from this account. Now, what happens is that every time there's a case, we don't touch the department beforehand. We do the case and charge them incrementally until the case has been finalized. That's how it works. So at any given point in time, you are never going to have this account balancing, and to the point where, if I say balancing, maybe that's the wrong word, but you're never going to have that account not having money, but at the same time not having overspent, because it will always be overspent at one point or the other. But what we haven't been doing for years is we haven't been recovering at the rate at which we started recovering from last year to now. Now, this year, as at the end of August 25th, we were owed in the region of 323 million from the account, right? And as at the end of August, or between April and August 2012, we had recovered 352 million. But as you recover, you are also spending. And that's the point of a revolving credit that I was using. I'm not saying the revolving credit in the strict sense of the word, but that's how it works. Can I explain it again, Chair? Other departments owe us money elsewhere. Yes. I was saying, why can't you take deposits like at the private again in different other departments? That's because we are a state attorney. That's why we can't. But the truth of the matter is that we've also, as a department, tried to look at models of, can we do like home after, I mean like foreign, like, what's DERCO? Can we do like DERCO? And if you are traveling, you have to pay in advance. Can we do it that way? I mean, we're looking at those models right now, which, certainly. But I also think that practically, at this stage, it doesn't look feasible, that model. We've kind of explored it a bit. We haven't explored it extensively. It doesn't look that feasible, but it's something that we're still looking at. The reality of the matter is that if you have a case from any department, you have to jump into action, do the case, and then start the collection process. What we have to do is to improve our collection process. And really, I must say, this is one area that I really, even if I have to say so myself, I am very proud of. Thank you. Okay, then.
Not off the budget vote at all. It's a separate fund. It's like an overdraft facility. It's not the trust that the money is going through. So the collection doesn't impact your budget vote at all, which I thought it might. So I fully understand that.
But then, DG, do you invoice the department? Because you see, the AG says you must use the 30-day rule. You pay within 30 days or else. And why doesn't that apply in this case? Because you're invoicing them. And so they should have 30 days in which to pay.
The observation is quite correct, and in my area session I had indicated that our collection processes had not happened sufficiently. So for this we only have ourselves to blame. And what we are doing now is that because we meet at WASAD once a month, every once a month I have an opportunity to meet not every DG, but those who are members of WASAD Mango, which I'm a member of, and I always remind them, please guys, time is up.
Sorry, can you continue?
What's happening? Forum of South Africa Director General, sorry, my apology. We literally remind ourselves nightly, and we have started seeing the improvement in the collection. I must, however, indicate that the departments that are under administration, in particular the Department of Education in Eastern Cape and Limpopo, we are still struggling there. But generally, and in fact what we've decided we will do, is that for Limpopo in particular, we are invoking National Treasury because they are responsible for the intervention. The same. Help us facilitate the
good luck with that. Those are the same people that cut you 680 million.
The other receivables like fines and that, which is mainly your third party, but see none of that, those funds collected as a result of your professional services rendered, which would entitle you to keep those funds as a payer, as opposed to paying it across to the National Revenue Fund. If you take the one small example is the conveyancing section in the state attorney that does conveyancing for all state departments. That's a professional service, but they can charge a fee. When that is paid, I understand that goes into the National Revenue Fund. Now we're trying to get money from Treasury, which is that same fund. They say you can't get it, you've got to take 1%. But we're paying into that fund continuously.
Thank you very much. One of the things that National Treasury has said to us, in fact, I think that aspect we left out in our proposal to National Treasury, they have said to us, charge departments. They just didn't say that to the Department of Justice alone. They said to everybody, and we all had to submit where opportunities of charging are going to come. So we forgot the conveyancing bit, so we'll hurry up and go and add it, and thanks for that. But there is some element of correctness in the observation, and it's something that we're going to take up. But the principles right now, as they obtain, is that any money that comes to the department is not entitled to keep. You paid over to the National Revenue Fund.
Mm-hmm.
That's the principle. It works the same way as the levies, your fuel levy and your every other levy. It works the same way. In fact, we've been trying to argue this in my previous life. We've been saying that we are collecting so much money for the RA, well, not exactly for the RAF, but from the levy, from the fuel levy. Why don't we get money just from that and pay back to the road accident fund when he was in trouble then? But we clearly it doesn't work like that, and unfortunately we still have to go cap in hand and in a queue and ask for money. But please remember as well, and I can understand Parliament is really trying to assist us, it really would be difficult for National Treasury because most departments are collecting some form of revenue one way or the other. For Treasury to make all these dispensations with us individually, otherwise they would not have a complete bill to see how much they've collected. So I do have sympathy with them. I think they must have been blaming after the Department of Justice. All right.
is your attorney's work. The attorney's authority, but then they run danger that the partner might say, well, if we pay for this attorney, then we'll go to private attorney. But attorneys, they don't charge attorney fees for the work that they do. They just do it as per course. And they could charge client fees to that, but there is a risk in that as well. They charge the advocate fees they recover, if I remember correctly, but no attorney's fees.
Hmm. And thanks for that. It's one of the areas where, at least that we have raised, and there has been so much contention because we are the equivalent sister, if I may put it that way.
It's so far as
people not having a choice, literally, we really would like people to use the state attorney in that sense. I don't mean the negative sense. I mean the positive sense that ideally for state litigation, we would like people to use the state attorney as the primary litigator and only get external private attorneys under exceptional circumstances. Now, if you start, if you charge on those bases, then people will say, well, what binds us here? We would rather go elsewhere. And so equivalent in that sense, not in the other, any other sense. Okay. All right, well, thank you. Then the last issue on vacancies. Let me just quickly, very quickly, because there's a slide that we are going to present when we finish our presentation, but let me speak very quickly on this. And I'll take them one by one. The CFO advertised, withdrawn, advertised, again, interviewed, as said in the document. We went through the security vetting and the psychometrics and all of those things. Decision was made on 8 candidates. And only after that process, we discovered a few things, and then that process had to stall again. We've re-advertised since then. And the details will come in the presentation. Secondly, the DDG Corporate Services, same story, advertised again, interviewed, we found a few issues, that process was again aborted, because we really were eyeing a complete package and couldn't get it, and eventually that process was aborted after the interviews and all of those other processes, unfortunately. The CON development, constitutional development, we advertised, the responses were poor, we didn't even move to the next level, we've re-advertised again, and that process again will come through in the presentation.
Implementation date for magistrates' courts on hire. You don't have to give us the date now, but I mean, if you can
put it tomorrow. Okay. We've been very lucky, because I remembered something when Honourable Member was asking a question. So we quickly checked and we found information which I'm happy to report on tomorrow. And then we will provide the implementation date. So it's not as gloomy as the Honourable Member has observed. There is a little bit of work that needs to be done, but there have been people that have been trained. We've now verified that, on fire specifically. We've asked for a designation process to happen. I've even written formally through my minister to the Chief Justice for the designation to happen. We just have to follow that process up. There has been slip up in the fact that we haven't followed that process up. We'll give the numbers and the details tomorrow. Excuse me? Public Works.
Mm-hmm. You want the question repeated?
Yes, please.
Ms. Schaefer. Sorry, can you repeat the public question?
Good.
I just want to know what exactly are the issues regarding public, because I know there's always complaints, and I would like to know more details. What exactly there are, problems are that you experience, and what, how we can, in your view, try and address them?
There are many challenges with public works, but maybe the ones that pertain to us, or at least that we would be relieved if they were unblocked, the capacity to advertise our requirements in time. Of course, it doesn't mean that in that we do not have a hand, but certainly if there was one area in the monthly meetings are intended just to check how far are we, can we advertise this one, why are we not advertising, and that type of thing, there just seems to be an issue in that area. The second, which we would really do with assistance on, is just ensuring that your broad-planned maintenance happens as scheduled, because if we do not maintain our infrastructure, the level of degradation just goes so quickly that by the time you have a little bit of money to do the maintenance, you are almost amounting to building new infrastructure, as it were, and we are concerned with that. The third area that we could do with assistance on is that we write and give them commitments early in the year. And with our technical challenges with those commitments, if we were to know early so that we can address those issues that they are raising much earlier, so that, again, we can do away with the delays. Other issues are housekeeping issues between us as departments, which, in my view, we can always address at a colleague-to-colleague level. But the most critical one, in terms of leases, we tell, okay, let me first set out the governance around leases. The requirement is that at least you must tell them 18 months before their lease is expiring. Now, whether we agree that time is reasonable or not, that's beside the point. We must tell them within 18 months. And invariably, in most cases, and I'm not going to say all, because there may be slip-ups on our part as well, but we tell them within the required period. Once we told them, and this has happened in few instances in the recent past, is that once you've told them that the lease is expiring at period X, the expectation is that we start getting into action in looking for an alternative building. We struggle with that aspect because it doesn't happen as quickly as it should. So the question is, what do we have to tell in 18 months? What we have said, and in the last meeting that we've had, was to say perhaps every other 6 months, maybe you tell in 18 months, you tell in 12 months, you tell in 6 months, and you tell in 3 months, so that we keep reminding each other. But if you look at the labor halt in Durban and all the issues that we've gone through, we are told in good time. If you look at the accommodation of the South African Law Reform Commission, we had told in good time, we were put on a month-to-month leasing for so long a period after telling in good time. If you look at the Justice College, we told in time and we were still put on a month-on-month, and I still think we are still on a month-on-month on Justice College. In fact, we're just about charged out by UNISA in that accommodation arrangement that they have done. So those are, and these things come with huge stress and anxiety to management, because every month you don't know what will happen. And so until you are physically kicked out like the South African Law Reform Commission, it's a huge cost for us, because then it means we must find an alternative accommodation, we must put their assets in storage and pay the storage costs. It really is a huge issue. So the lease for portfolio management, we could do with assistance there. And so if those, of course I can't list everything else, if we can just do with those, that would be the assistance we would appreciate quite greatly. But even in our own environment, and I really don't want this to be a public works pressing question, even within our own environment as the Department of Justice, our contract management in terms of managing our own portfolio and the capacity, I mean the technical capacity to do that, we can do with an improvement. And this is an area that as a department that is responsible for so much infrastructure, our portfolio is so huge, it is absolutely has become such an essential issue in terms of us building that capacity. Unfortunately, we had not focused on that capacity, and it's one area that we must focus on. Not just for ourselves. Remember that most of the infrastructure that we procure is not just for the Department of Justice. We procure for ourselves, for the NPA, and until the Office of the Chief Justice gets out of our portfolio, for that office as well. So it's really important that we improve on our own capacity as well. But I honestly, genuinely believe that even as public works has its own flaws like we do, but if we had better capacity to manage our own environment as well, we probably would have been in a less worse off situation if there's anything like that in English. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. You referred, and I'm not for one moment suggesting we must bash public works, although they deserve a bashing. But you refer to the lease portfolio, and there's throughout your report reference to leases. When the minister appeared before us, as we require him to do from time to time, he made reference to this, and he has a very strong view on this. And his view is that he does not see why lease agreements should be entered into so that the people who are already very wealthy should become even wealthier. Now, there seems to be a policy in government to go for lease agreements. And you refer to the Law Reform Commission and stuff like that. And I really can't understand, okay, in the present climate it's not possible, because you're expected to cut your hair and mow your lawn and so on. But at some point, the economy will improve, and so I have no doubt you are looking at that, so that instead of paying these 5-10-year leases, and somebody calculates that at the end of the 2-year lease, you could have bought ground, land, and put up structure, and saved the lease that you're paying out for the next 8 years. Do you have a view on that, yourself and your senior management?
Thank you, Chair. I'm sure my senior management will have a view on this. Let me take a quick step and then throw the issue to management to assist me. There are two issues, Chair. The first is the here and now. The immediate pressures because of growth in our business, which we must attend to almost immediately. That can't wait for the actual physical construction of our own space. So that is the first issue. There, we feel that leasing is an appropriate mechanism. The medium to long-term arrangement, we do feel that in some instances, we could look at construction, but in other instances, we might perhaps continue on a leasing mode. And these are the circumstances that we might look at construction. For instance, in an environment where we are closer together as head office, that would be one area, just so that we consolidate all our head office complement within the Pretoria environment. But it would not make sense, for instance, to go and build in an environment where your administrative staff or your court staff is so small that your construction cost will outweigh the others. So we look at those as the two models, and that's how currently we are trying to manage our portfolio. So that is really the principle behind it. But there are other drivers that drive whether we are going to leave or we are going to rent. Or we're going to build. The one driver is, if we do not have confirmation of an allocation of the budget for construction, we can't then go and commit on that. We first have to know that we will have the budget so that we're able to do that. So these are the things that we put together in a basket of thought process. Out comes the option
and then we take that option and as a result. And I agree with the test and observation that in the long term, it's better to own your own infrastructure because then you determine the pace of your maintenance, you determine the pace of everything around your own infrastructure. And by right, we should try and do that as much as possible. And I think when Treasury came to the party and gave us about a little over a billion, to do infrastructure for this year and next year and the following year, I think they had that in mind, especially for costs that have significant traffic, like your South Gauteng High Court and perhaps your Nduzuma, for instance, and other areas that have real, real big traffic. It would be better to build there than to rent a court environment, especially because court infrastructure, when you are leasing it, the actual, I don't know what's the English version, making the building ready to operate as a court is so expensive. It's not like moving house and knocking a wall there and just putting a bedroom. But it's, you have to change the whole modality of that building for it to be a courthouse. And we spend really shocking money just doing that. Only for 2 years or 3 years and then move next door, or only for 10 years and move next door. And if you look at the regulations around how you shall run a business in terms of giving an address, changing an address, just the administrative cost of moving buildings every 5 years or every 10 years is really, really costing us a lot of money. So if you take the operation and you not only limit yourself to the operation and then look at the construction cost, if you put everything together, it really, in the final analysis, makes more sense to build your own infrastructure than to rent. Thanks, sir.
Thanks, sir. Just want to add, I agree with the DG that indeed the court for all intents and purposes, they will always be there, you know. So I agree that it doesn't make sense to leave. For example, we have a building in Rustenburg, just outside Rustenburg called Tavan. It's a court. We've left the building. We struggle with the owner to maintain the building because we don't have money. Many years ago, you know, so we didn't take the view that we will fix and return to actually reclaim our money. So what we don't end up doing, you know, we could be using our legal professionals to do something else, but now we've got to be changing this person to recover for the court, because if we've been waiting for the landlord to fix the place is leaking, the court is not working, you know, so we have having to figure. I agree that especially, you know, the court, established towns, you know, that they will always be a need for court because the court runs by government. I think we really need to prioritize those areas and look at the amount of money that we pay per month on rentals. It's shocking, you know, so I support the DG that really in those areas we should change the policy. And I think you will see tomorrow on the slides that will be presented how it also affects as on capital costs, because the bulk of the money is then moving into leaseholds. And so we want to find that there are many questions like, but it should be unable to build new buildings. Thank you.
Just on the question of who runs the South African Judicial Education Institute, the Dr. Homolima Moshu has been seconded from the NPA. Dr. Homolimo Moshwing has been seconded from the NPA to run SAGE as an administrator. Of course, I think that this is known. The Chief Justice is the chairperson of the board of SAGE. So Dr. Moshwing reports to the Chief Justice and the board. The post of administrator has been advertised. My recollection is that by the end of the month, interviews will have taken place. So now then, who would be appointed? Yeah. Is that straight?
Thanks, Chair. The decision reminds me of the matter Philila Mulong, the court in the Northwest. It's a multi-purpose community center. I think one of the honorable members said that it will actually not be utilized. And maybe then that's when it was starting. But I can tell you, I've been there myself. I'm from the Northwest. It's a very beautiful facility. Housing for government departments and servicing the people in that area. And there's no fancy, you know, the people between South Africa and Botswana just move in and out. But the community in that area is about 100 kilometers away from Mafikeng. So if we don't close that court, I can tell you the hardship that the people in that area would suffer. And that's why I think government departments came together to put up the structure. We continue to work with the social development, health, to actually provide the services. And the court is serviced by the court in Mafikeng. So it is actually fully functional. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Now we are on program one, and most of the questions that have been asked have already basically touched primarily on program one and maybe moved also to other programs. But the purpose of Program 1 is to manage the department, is to develop policies and strategies for efficient administration of justice and to provide centralized support services throughout the business. We have five strategic objectives for Program 1. The one is increased compliance with prescripts to achieve and sustain an unqualified audit. Here we are talking about all elements of the reporting line, but we're also talking both finance as well as the performance information, but we are also talking about all our funds that we are responsible for. Two, improved management of fraud and corruption cases. Three, improved human resources services. Four, increased optimization of systems. Both the automated systems and in cases where we still don't have automated systems, manual systems. The last one is increased percentage of outstanding PRC victims who qualify for reparations paid as per the PRC recommendation. Insofar as the performance of Program 1, unqualified audit opinion by the end of 2012-2013 financial year, I think we've discussed this issue at length around what are we doing in terms of TPF. I think that we can probably just look at operationally rather than the things that we are talking about slightly earlier where we were talking about the reporting and the governance requirements. So operationally, we have completed the comprehensive review of documentary and systems as well as processes to manage the fund. While 160 area court managers, financial operations managers, senior financial management were also trained on basic financial management as well as the principles behind that and the appropriate financial reporting frameworks for the trust fund. Now, naturally, most people who are working in government would be more familiar with accounting in terms of the PFMA, but here we have to train slightly differently because the issues that we were looking at are very specific to trust fund management. And that is why we had to train them specifically. The third bullet there, we also trained in a form of orientation 1,021 officials on financial month-end transactions. Now, on every month end, there are certain transactions that we run and processes that we run, and we have to ensure that by the end of November 2011, we've done that, so that you'd recall that we said we are now sending teams to check if people are following up on the things that we have trained them on in terms of getting us ready for the year end of 2011-2012 financial year in terms of submitting an financial statement. So all of that was preparing people to be able to do that. The fourth bullet is we also did training interventions, and we continue to do training interventions even as we speak in 2012-2013 financial year. As a matter of fact, two of my colleagues who are here, Hisham as well as Mr. Malema, how can I forget his name? Mr. Malema will be going to the Eastern Cape region to assist our that region, which we believe is one of our struggling regions, just to ensure that we up the tempo and get the systems going, because we wouldn't want that region to be caught by audit still at the same level. So we've asked these two colleagues, because in their environment we find that there is, insofar as the MCAP is concerned, almost absolutely clean environment. And I must say this, and I keep saying this every time I come here, that it's not all bad in the Department of Justice. And we are very proud of Hisham. He's really led by example. He's consistently has received for the Western Cape an unqualified audit. He just is so unfortunate to be sitting with all of us, but he's an inspiration. So we all want to grow up and be like Hisham. But in the Northwest, they may not have the glory of Hisham, but I can say this, the Northwest is a leader in the implementation of EFT, and we really want them to go there and see what can be done in that environment, because you would recall, honorable members, that one of the issues, it's not just the accounting parts we are trying to fix. We are also concurrent with it, trying to get the services to the people, because one of our strategic objectives was to say we want to improve maintenance payment to beneficiaries. So we are taking a two-pronged approach to achieve those two outcomes all at the same time if we can. So that is why we are sending the two colleagues there. All right. Then we have an audit action plan that we've developed for this environment, and the audit action plan we've taken all the issues that the Auditor General had identified. We've taken all other management issues that we felt were necessary to address. We are also populating it. We haven't finalized the population process yet with the internal audit findings, but what we said was, we have done the first sign-off of the plan, and I want to explain this a little bit. We can't be developing plans for the whole year and not do the implementation. So we took what we could take as clear as possible, defined what we wanted to define and clarified in the plan what we wanted to clarify, and then we said, let me sign off, you start implementing, but concurrent with the implementation process, pull in the internal audit findings as well. And so that is now happening. They are busy running that through this plan, the audit action plan. The audit action plan is really in the department managed by two colleagues supported by officials in their units. One of them is heading the Justice College right now. The other is in service delivery. And the two were an appropriate choice for us to do this work for these reasons. One, the one responsible for service delivery, he has an interest in ensuring that we do all the right things to improve service delivery. The other who's responsible for training in Justice College is to ensure that he identifies all the areas concurrent with his work where we can train because there are certain areas and deficiencies that we need to
we need to improve on. I did say earlier that this plan started not last year, started last year, but it's now being affected this year. Last year we achieved quite significantly against the plan, but at the end of the financial year, we then discovered through the audit process that our measurements were not that smart, and so this year we worked on measurements, and we believe that we now have this wonderful fishbone and the calculator process that will tell us how to calculate at the end of every quarter the performance that we claim to have achieved. We also are doing work in the risk management environment. We had targets. We achieved 64% of the risk mitigation plans. We finalized in good time by December. We had anticipated and planned for finalizing 100. So this is one of the indicators that we didn't achieve fully, as the Auditor General said. But what we did was we had targeted that we were going to conclude 29 risk mitigation plans and do the visits to the regions around that by 31st March, and that aspect we did do sufficiently. There are a number of initiatives that we did in the risk management area, which we believe have assisted us quite significantly in improving our business. But there are some areas that we needed to have gone back and tightened up on still in this area. We had a number of vacant posts in the risk management area, which we were able to fill, but this is one area where we have been very vulnerable. We kind of have a revolving door syndrome where we appoint a lot of people, but also a lot of people leave. I think this is a new competence, and a lot of people are looking for risk managers, and so we are having a little bit of a challenge today. We do have a retention strategy in the department in case there is a thinking that we don't. We do, but we just need to perhaps rethink the levels at which the colleagues are appointed at in the risk management environment. Concurrent with that, we appointed a lot of risk champions because we believe that there is no doubt in my mind and in the minds of executives that at head office level, we all understand the pressures that affect our business. But at regional levels, we are sitting at different levels of understanding. So that is why we are saying there must be a risk champion at every environment, not just sitting at head office. They are going to be feeding back to us to tell us these are the risks in this environment and these are the risks in a different environment, and these are the mitigation interventions. So that we have done, but we've also said the same risk champions will also serve as compliance champions throughout the organization so that we improve both the risk management and the compliance almost at the same time. So we've done those appointments now. But last year, during the period under review, there were areas that we had not done the appointments just because of lack of capacity on the ground. We believe that the risk management initiatives will assist the department to move from the current evaluation outcomes that we got from National Treasury, where they came in to assess our risk and where we are in terms of the maturity of the department in managing risk. They found that we were 3 and we want to move to level 4. Of course, I must indicate that we are at a level where most departments are at. Most departments are sitting either at level 3 and very few departments are at level 4 and even fewer departments are at level 5. In fact, I can't recall from the top of my mind which department would be at level 5 in terms of risk management. So we are not uncomfortable with where we have been found to be, but I met, as a matter of fact, with National Treasury last week specifically to discuss this and to discuss how can we improve our rating a little quicker and what sort of support can Treasury give us. And we've locked some reasonable understanding, and I followed up with written confirmation to the DG on the type of assistance I think we need.
so that we can be rated slightly differently, because we would have been slightly readier than if we're doing it alone. So in fact, just to share with the committee, some of the support we had said if they could give us is the internal audit support, as well as the risk management support personnel. Because we said it's one thing giving us all the requirements. I mean, we can read them for ourselves. But can you also give us the people who can assist us as well? So that's what we are working on with National Treasury. Of course, we've codified a lot of instructions now, and my worry is the more instructions we issue might even confuse us, and we really want to try and manage down some of the instructions that we are issuing, because we also don't want to confuse people. But the instructions that we've issued in the risk management environment, we believe, and in the financial environment, we believe, are still able to help us clarify issues. What we need to do is to go back and say, which ones do we not need anymore, so that we take that out. Otherwise, you then end up in the compliance mode rather than in the working type mode. In managing our fraud and corruption in the environment, one of the questions that we continue to deal with is how quickly can we do this? Now, in this slide, our apologies, we should have added what was our target. We had two types of targets in this area. For the new cases, we wanted to achieve, for every new case registered, we wanted to achieve a target of 50%. We will update the slides for the Honourable House. And for the old cases, we wanted to have achieved a target of 65% in terms of completion of investigations. These are just investigations, and I want just to clarify that. Now, out of the target of 50%, of new cases, we received 144 cases. We finalized 117 cases. So the percentage finalization, we were sitting at 81% at the end of the financial year. Out of that, we had to get the sanction, which was a dismissal sanction. In one case, we were able to dismiss, just as a result of this exercise, 14 officials almost immediately dismissed after the investigations, of course. But in total, we as a result of our forensics, we have been able to dismiss 31 officials. 7 were given final written warnings, 5 were resigned as a result of the investigations, naturally. However, the point we are trying to raise there is that These are not, if you look at our annual report, just in case you think there's inconsistency with the numbers, these are the people that were dismissed only as a result of forensic investigations. There are other methods of dealing with misconduct that we also did, which pushed the numbers up. So it's 31 is not everybody that was dismissed last year alone. We have a bigger number than 31, but 31 was as a result of forensic investigations. With respect to With respect to old cases, in other words, these are the ones that have been coming over a period of time. The target, you would recall, I said it was 65%. We were dealing with 78 cases. Of the 78, we finalized 58 cases. The percentage of finalization was 78, which was slightly higher than, in fact, it was reasonably higher than the target. What we also had to do during the period under review was to really run extensive training and workshops and all of those things which were required, unfortunately, to run, not because people don't know that fraud is illegal and that we shouldn't do it and corruption is wrong, but you still have to remind people anyway. So we ran those 31 workshops in the year, and we had planned to run 30. We were able to do 21 because of availability of officials. Please also remember that we can't keep our officials all the time in training. We've got a business to run. We also had a good session with Alama, and that session was for us as executive management and some senior management. and we really appreciated having that session. Other initiatives that we did during this process is we approved the fraud prevention plan. We also approved the whistleblowing policy. So people are blowing a lot of whistles in the department right now, and we try and protect them as required. And if I say protect the identity of those who are blowing the whistle. But from time to time, you will find that some of the issues where people are alleged to be blowing whistles is information that is already there, that we are already working on. Fraud prevention implementation plans, we are rolling that out now, which we developed last year. We are also monitoring a lot more. We are doing preventative interventions, detection interventions, and of course, corrective interventions are being done right now in the department. In line with this plan, we've raised awareness, if you're looking for numbers, to a total of 2,500 officials during the year under review. And if you know the total complement of the department, that number is a drop in the ocean, but we believe we've targeted the right areas, for instance, supply chain management, as well as other critical areas like in HR, where some of this training has gone to, and of course, senior management. In addition to the above, we've had 89 ethics champions appointed to continue the training on the trainer methodology, because we can't always afford to send people into the training that we are paying for. The cluster, the JCPS cluster under output 3, which is dealing with corruption activities within the cluster and within government, ran a program last year, starting from local authorities all the way to national departments, where we were saying, let's vet people in supply chain management. We submitted, even in my department, we submitted every other person who is working in supply chain management. Their details have been submitted to state security for vetting, NIA in particular, and we are waiting for the outcomes. But I know, as a matter of fact, that we as a department complied with the requirements, so all we have to get now are the benefits of the exercise. Time of vetting, this is an area where we've really, really been slow on, and when the Auditor General said, well, vetting has not been happening, he wasn't literally talking, okay, maybe he was, but my reading of what he's saying is that he wasn't talking only about the broad, detailed vetting that gives you a top clearance or a top secret or whatever other outcome, but he was talking about the preliminary type vetting. Now, he was correct that we were not doing that, but we still started doing that. So as you sit waiting for interview, to go into an interview, you take your fingerprints now and we do your prelims before we even interview you, which is what we introduced last year. We didn't have that methodology, but it's there now, and it's, I believe, working. It gives us the preliminary outcomes as quickly as we are able to get them before we even go to cabinet, especially insofar as senior management is concerned, but also at other levels of the organization. You have your fingerprint man sitting there, or woman sitting there, and it's just that it's only the men that I see. And then...
The AD is not talking about the NIA stuff. This is your own internal process that they were talking about.
That's what I'm saying, my interpretation, because the NIA stuff, it still does take long to get out, but the prelims at least must be there for a person. Yeah, well, he may have been talking about that. I'm not disputing it. But insofar as we are concerned, please also, I really want to make this known. State Security, some few years ago, I can't remember exactly when, tried to decentralize the vetting capacity back to departments, except for the issuing of top clearance but we've been saying to them, look, we really are struggling to get this capacity in the Department of Justice. So really we've struggled. We have appointed people. They are doing administrative work in terms of getting the forms, getting all of those things done. But the technical competence of sitting there and saying the person is good or is bad in terms of whatever it is that they look at, we really are struggling with that. Of course, there is a lot of turnover, as I had already said. By the way, this section is in risk management as well. So when I'm talking about high turnover, I'm also talking about that area of work. Again, insofar as vetting is concerned, they even came to my office and they reminded me that my security clearance had issues, that I needed to fit in a hurry, and so I'm also working on that. So awareness, I can leave them because they came to see me about it. And I'm working on those things. Not that I didn't have security clearance, but I did have it. All right. And then the safety environment. There is a small issue. Actually, I think it's a big issue now in government because of the broadness of our infrastructure portfolio. One of the critical requirements in terms of legislation is that we have to provide for a secure and a safe, habitable working environment. We're struggling with the maintenance issue that I articulated earlier, both of our own buildings as administration as well as of course. And so this remains one big issue for us. But for the purposes of what we are talking about here, security infrastructure is, you'd recall I mentioned 150, we brought down the target to 90 because of cost and all of those issues. This is the slide I was referring to. But in addition to that, which is the second Roman numeral 2 under security incidents, we were able to achieve our target. Our target is to reduce the number of security breaches that happen in a court. But you, in the past week, well, in the past few days, you would have read about the shooting or you listened to the news about the shooting in Durban, in Buzuma, and Berlin, I think was it yesterday in Berlin. We are still trying to ascertain, of course, the details, whether it was within or outside the parameters of the two courts. We know that in Duzuma it was outside the parameters, but how close to the court still remains an issue because we have security contracts in place. And so we were worried when we saw that ourselves. I just indicate that our risk incidents are likely to increase, especially with all the unrest and the issues that have been obtaining in the country in the recent past. But we have been lucky that we haven't had too negative an incident yet within the parameters of a court. And I'm specifying because within the vicinity of a court, we have had negative incidents. How have we addressed the security challenges? We have addressed the security challenges in this way. In terms of security infrastructure to date, we had planned to have 70 designs. We were able to achieve and complete 58 designs, security designs, that is. And in part, because most of the buildings are very old, and to get the building plans and all of those issues really become an issue. And when you are dealing with security, it does impact on your electricity installations and the like. And so you can't take that very lightly. And so as a result, we are not able to achieve our target there. But we performed above your 50% mark in terms of that. We achieved 58 out of the courts that we had prioritized, and we had prioritized 90 courts at the time. But in addition to these sites, we also worked with the Department of Public Works, just amongst others, to improve other things like your perimeter fencing and the like within our courts. Unfortunately, we didn't specify each of those issues in the presentation, but we can provide that information. But in terms of the current contracts that we have, you have 707 sites, and we call them sites very deliberately because some of them are not necessarily caught, which are guarded, versus the previous year, which we had 645 sites that had security guards in them. But you would know that even as we have new business pressures like your commissions we are securing differently, it means we are pulling some of these resources elsewhere because we are not entering into new contracts for security of the commission. In terms of the security offices, that bullet, which is bullet Roman numeral 2, there are 510 offices that are assisted with cash in transit services versus the previous year where we had 502 offices that had cash in transit facilities or security facilities. I really want to pause here just a little bit. I had said earlier that as at the end of the financial year 2011-2012 or the year under review, we had 103 courts where we were already paying through EFT. The impact of that will begin to be realized here. It's not been realized yet. The more we move paying people in cash over the counter and paying through an EFT process will enable us to negotiate our security contract a lot better because we'll less cash in transit. And if you look at our security portfolio, this is where we pay the most, in the cash guarding rather than in people guarding type. So this is an area we are eyeing very, and so we are saying Johan move so that we can move the negotiation in terms of cash in transit. We continue to provide specialized protection for members of the judicial, especially where we feel that they are at more risk, especially in those environments where you have drug-related cases, because we know that the prosecution and the judiciary are generally at a higher threat level than anywhere else. So we continued to provide security there. Now, in terms of just other security interventions that we did, to be very specific, securing them in some instances extraordinarily, we had to do that because it was over and above the normal security that we provide. You recall that last year, was it last year or this year, we had an incident against So that's just, not only did it affect her, of course physically it affected her, but it meant that we also needed to start looking around to say what is the level of exposure of other judges, and really does put a lot of pressure on us. And unfortunately, when people are looking for something from the Department of Justice, the expectation is that it shall come. We secured the cash hold a lot better. You would recall that we were saying that our cash holds were being broken into, they were being burgled. I think we saw a lot less of those incidences last year or during the year under review, and I am hoping that we see a lot less during this year as well. The security that are doing guarding as well as that type of work have also benefited from the use of the CCTV cameras that we have in the system, which we've invested in. Perimeter fencing, as I was indicating earlier, exits and entry points is secured a lot better. Unlike the tunnel we put ourselves in Western Cape a little while back, where the security entrance points that were lower than they should have been, we started up those problems out. And the drop-off areas for prisoners, we've improved on those so that we see a lot less people running, well, breaking away or, I don't know, running away? Escaping, yes, that's the right way. Okay. Yes, I am. Okay. All right. Now, court safety, as I said, we've improved monitors. The monitors now in place. That slide just talks to the investment in infrastructure.
sorry, I apologize. That slide talks to one of the issues that was raised, and I was reading some of the previous questions that were raised, was whether in fact we are managing these contracts. And we said, amongst others, the reason why we changed the contracting model that we had the previous years of having one big contractor for the totality of our portfolio was because we wanted to see if we could negotiate better rates with each service provider. That has given us a lot of grey hairs, but we have been able to negotiate a lot of conditions slightly differently, and are trying to manage them slightly differently. But one of the areas that we've been able to manage and start implementing a lot harder during the year under review were penalties. If there is a breach, you would recall, Honourable Member, that we had breaches before which we couldn't hold or we didn't hold anybody liable. If there is a breach in your area and you are covering security there, we are now charging it against you, and we will look afterwards. And we think that this is one of the areas that is helping us in improving the less, in improving our breach ratio. And we think it has helped us to have less breaches in the system. This doesn't cover, however, the losses that we always have and the replacement costs. But it does give us a starting point from which we can then replace some of the things that we lose as a result of the negligence of other parties. Of course, the budget constraints on security that we have already spoken about, I'm not going to repeat that in too much of a detail. The second slide, we said to date a minimum amount of 325 million is needed to address the current demand. That's because of all the expansions in our business, the expansions in specialized security and all of that. And this really for us is one budget item, one expenditure item that we just cannot sustain. We truly, if there's one area that if we had our way we could take out from our budget line, it would be this area, because it's just growing uncontrollably. Not because of poor negotiations, of course, we can negotiate better, but just because as our business expands, it means our security must expand. And security is just so exorbitant. But this is worldwide. It's not just in South Africa. Security is just the biggest line item that we would wish to wish away, but unfortunately it's here with us to stay. In fact, it really, really worries us that we may have to cut services in other areas to be able to fund the thing, and it gives me personally sleepless nights. Just to move then towards a closure of that slide, our contracts, the current ones, are coming to an end in December. We are in the procurement process now. This procurement process, you would recall that we had said to the Honourable Members we were going to look at options of how can we make our security affordable. It is only through this procurement process that we are going to have to get our best foot forward in how we negotiate the prices. The difficulty is that these are parties who've been playing in our environment for a reasonable period and are playing in government environment anyway, and they probably know how much government can pay, but we have to get our best negotiators going forward as we conclude this area. Now we talk about the vacancy rate. On the vacancy rate, we had a very long, and I would wish to give to Mr. Mpolo, but I will not. I will allow just for the flow of the presentation just to deal with that issue as well. But we had a lot of conversations on whether in fact our vacancy rate in terms of targeting is sitting at the correct level. We looked at ourselves, we looked at DPSA, and we said, if DPSA is sitting at this, why are we saying we should have a vacancy rate of 7%? You'd recall that at some point we were gunning for 7%.
But looking at the realities of the cost, realities of tight budgets, realities of OSD, realities of all the things that we've discussed, can we actually afford, and of course realities of space, can we afford to have a vacancy rate being targeted at 7%? And we concluded last year and that it's not practical. We have to revise the target differently, and we have since revised it differently, as you can see in the slide. However, now from a performance point of view, we are saying that we were not able to meet the target of the target of 7%, we ended up at, what was it, 10.52%. But as at the first quarter of this year already, we are sitting at 10.10%. Now, that is beginning to tell us that we can actually cut that vacancy rate slightly lower than target, and we want to try and keep to that going forward. Where are these vacancy rates happening broadly? In my response to the question about the senior management, executive management to be precise, we had already indicated that at the executive level, that's where we have the most vacancy rates, and that's the area that we had conversations with our ministers today. Please, after JSC, can we try and focus on this area? And he has assured us that we will focus on this area, but unfortunately, this is where we need minister plus other ministers to do the appointments. And we are very hopeful that by the end of the financial year, we would have closed the thing. Now, insofar as the information that has been requested on providing detail around dates and all of that around vacancy rates, we will provide that information tomorrow. In fact, I think we do have... Can you open that drop down? The information is already contained as an update. What we did, just to speak to this document, which we will provide to members, what we did was we looked at what was the question originally when we had to respond, can't remember by the time, 23rd of July. What was the question? What was our response? What is the situation now? So we updated that document. It speaks to all the issues that we were ever asked by this Honourable House, and the responses provided and the updates. And we will leave that document.
Is it different to this document?
It's an update of that document.
So it's just looking at what's on the screen, I can't see any difference. I hope, just check if it is an update or not.
It is, if you look, it has an extra, just look at, for instance, 12. Just as you see it there.
Yeah.
Sorry, go back. Let's just look at the CFO.
CFO is under the corporate services, number 10.
10, when's it?
Yeah, same. No, not there.
Okay, we can just double check that, because maybe we'll have the wrong document. But, sorry, let me go slowly, because I'm trying to just double check myself. Oh, sorry. The document has been updated, Alka. Double check the CFO. No, I mean for the member. Oh, sorry for the member. We will just double check this and we'll beam it again tomorrow. But it's there. It's
provide you with updates and all of that. I'll just double check slightly after this meeting just to ensure that everything else has been updated. But indeed, we have worked on that document. So we can go back to the presentation. We can pass that. Thank you very much. Now we move to the training by Justice College. We've already shown you the slide. We were showing you one line, which is that line of training of the magistrates. So that's the complete picture. The long and the short of this is that we had a target which we were not able to meet. We trained quite sufficiently, but we didn't train as per what we had targeted. But in addition, we went and trained the judiciary as per the request of IJ, because at the time they were not able to do the training. And that's all that we want to say on that slide. Grievances and misconduct. If you go through this, you would realize that I had spoken slightly earlier that we had a project plan in place to finalize 65% of misconduct cases as well as grievances. And against this target, we were able to achieve 50% as against misconduct and 65% as against grievances. The slide below shows you, the table below shows you the grievances. In 2010-2011, we had a target of 6%. We were able to achieve the actual of 40%. In 2011-2012, we had a target of 50% because we looked at our capacity in-house and we looked at our processes, so we revised the target somewhat. We were able to achieve 65%. For quarter one, we are already targeting 60%. And we are already sitting, for quarter one targets, we were targeting 60% and we are already sitting at 34%, which means we are not actually achieving this target, but we are hoping we will be able to make up for the lost time, because quarter one has the end of the financial year end and all of these other issues that take a little bit of time in terms of focusing our attention to grievances as well as misconduct. Insofar as misconduct is concerned, in 2010-2011, we had a target of 70%. We underachieved hopelessly by 48%. In 2011-2012, we revised the target slightly down by 5%, and we were able to achieve just on the spot. We had an actual of 65%. This year, we started off with a quarter one target of 75%. We are hopelessly behind target, but we, again, because of all the activities of quarter one, we believe that after this, we should be able to pick up performance. Now we're talking about TRC payments. We had targets, again, that we had identified or agreed that we were going to do. Please recall that in the previous year, we had a great target, but we hopelessly underachieved. In fact, we did not achieve anything. We only were able to pay 8 beneficiaries. But during the year under review, we had targeted to pay 500 beneficiaries. We were able to pay 446 transactions. And I really have to clarify that. The reason why I'm saying transactions is because in some instances they are disputes within families, so you had to pay them as individuals rather than paying as one transaction. So that figure, in fact, is not an accurate reflection if you look at we had to pay 500 families, but we paid 435 in actual fact, translating into 446 transactions. So under actual, we should have written 435 and probably open a bracket and say amounted to 446 transactions. And that's what I just wanted to clarify. We have said for ourselves, and we remain true to that commitment, that this year is the last year that we have to pay anybody. Just like we said this year is the last year that we are having an audit qualification, this one area where whoever we have not paid, we will find and we'll pay this year. Because it's the last year here. Thank you. No, we didn't. Can I remind the House what we said last year about the audit? We said, if you go back to our strategy say we will get an unqualified audit opinion by 2012-2013 financial year. Yes, that's what he said.
So let's ask the thing, because I see you then go on to IT. You know, the WASOP stuff you gave us in the July report,
because there's other things you're meant to do with TRC, and that's the regulations.
Yes.
So is it no unchanged from the July report? Answer. Huh? Yeah. And then you haven't mentioned that you had ruling against you by the public protector.
Sorry, I missed that. It's about the public protector.
You have a ruling against you on this issue from the public protector. A ruling, it's reported in the annual report. To the annual report, unfortunately I wasn't able to, it wasn't on their website, I think it's report number 2 of last financial year. It wasn't on their website, but she did reproduce a little bit of it in the annual report. The effect basically was that they weren't saying anything about the payment, because I think they expected, but the department is ordered to finish the regulations for the health and everything else.
We have finished the regulations, but my good colleague will speak to that. Thank you, sir.
What are we going to do with the funding? Can I suggest
that we maybe volunteer Mr. Romano for lawn cutting duty at a certain, whatever course of the... criteria worked out, then, yeah, that's something that needs to be done. What qualifies a community to apply for rehabilitation? Then it would be an issue of, okay, once you qualify, how much money is available? But I think very much I would agree with you that what is needed needs to come from the community. It's not from some official in the Department of Justice or even the municipality to say you're building a hall there. It needs to be the community to say, look, we decided we've got a memorial, but can we have a sports field for the youth to, we don't have one, can you renovate the sports field or something like that. So it needs to be the people themselves, but those other criteria need to be worked on. And if this agreement was signed in March, what has happened, what is it to report from the IDT in October?
I just wanted to check whether anything ever came of the proposal from the Institute for Reconciliation and the proposal for a really big bursary, because there is so much money sitting in the President's Fund. You were quite taken with the idea at the same time I was.
No, the idea has been included in the regulations. I think both regulations on basic education and regulations on higher education. Particularly higher education, we tackle skills development, we tackle adult basic education and training. We also deal with tertiary education and the bursaries that we granted to victims or children of victims. So it is accommodated.
Yeah, I don't know. A response on those comments on the community rehabilitation, because I'm just worried that, to summarize, one is the agreement was signed at the IDT in March. What have they done since then? It's 6 months at least or more. Two, the concerns I've raised of which communities are going to qualify. Has anyone worked on that?
Okay, if I then, my sincere apology for the dialogue. But it took a bit of time for the minister to approve the methodology that we proposed to choose communities, but also to agree on the 18 communities that we have chosen throughout the country. If it will suit the chair, I think if I can have some space tomorrow, I can take you through the communities that the minister has approved that we focus on, as well as the methodology we have chosen to look at the communities. It's about 18 communities, so tomorrow I can give you a full briefing on it if it is a community, so that you have a sense of what communities are we going to focus on.
I have a bit of a problem with the way this is going, where it's almost like squeezing information out in terms of, this is a public meeting now. You've got quite well-organized NGOs in this section, and I'm thinking particularly of Kulumani, which will be quite deliberate. So suddenly we hear at the tail end, know that 18 communities have been identified. Yes, you need to, because you can't start implementing in those 18 communities, and when another community says, why were we left out, that you then say, no, you weren't part of the 18 that we identified. So I think you really have to, you can discuss it after we've adjourned, but I mean, you're going to have to, before you start implementing, come clean with which are the 18 and what are the criteria.
We're happy to do that, because all the communities that we have chosen, they come from TRC reports, which at this stage are public documents, and the minister never approved anything outside those reports.
Before we move off the thing, just the linkage with public protector. One of the public protector's complaints is government not implementing her recommendations. And she gave us a breakdown of who the most complaints are against. And not the majority, but the largest category is justice. was a majority. Majority is like over 50%. It was just as that it was local government. Now, our complaint to the public protector was, well, you're not telling us what your recommendations are about the department and the entities that we perform oversight over. So she agreed with that. We did ask her for material on the department and the master's office, which she said she would supply by, well, which she doesn't seem to have supplied. But my difficulty is that, Chair and DG, that, you know, I don't know why she investigated, dealt with this complaint. I think it was by Kulumani or somebody on the TRC, because in a sense all the information she came up with was already information before the committee. But anyway, she did. But why is it that it doesn't feature in your report as the department to us, in your annual report? It's a complaint against the public protector, the office, rather than against the department. But I think it just shows that, you know, there needs to be greater synergy between the recommendations that the public protector is making and the parliamentary committees and the departments. Because at the moment it just seems to be the public protector does her thing and gets her media coverage and whatever, and the departments do their own thing over here and there the twain shall meet.
Specifically said it wasn't that. She specifically said it was because the department wasn't responding. Because we asked her, why are you doing it, and the department is busy with TRC process. She said because she was not getting a response from the department.
Thank you very much. This is going to be difficult for me to respond without also sharing my feelings with the committee. So allow me to do that, and I don't mean to be mean or anything. The issues related to the public protect are a number, and we are responding. That is, if we do receive communication. Maybe the issue that I take personal issue with is the manner in which issues are raised with the department, at what point are they escalated, what is the entry point, what is the exit point, at which point decisions are made. Firstly, you hear about the findings either a month after. If you miss the television show, you probably would hear about a month after. The engagement by the Office of the Public Protector would be at the level of various levels in the organization. There wouldn't be a single meeting with myself by either the CEO of the Public Protector or the Public Protector herself. In spite of that, there are weaknesses in our own system at the department where we have been given information and we do take time to respond. There are two of those issues that I can speak to very specifically. One is the issue that she picked up around the rape, which has been covered quite significantly in the media, and I do not intend to deal with the details, which we have closed. But during the currency of this issue, whilst we're handling with it, with all our mishaps, and I am not blaming the public protector, I'm saying with all our mishaps in our own internal processes, we nonetheless also ask the public protector for certain specific things, which unfortunately, and I'm not saying it was the public protector's office or the public protector herself, but these issues ended up in the media when I, as an accounting officer, had written to the public protector directly. Regardless of that, we concluded the issue. We are picking up a lot of issues on the media, and again, on issues that we have now concluded. So that is the first issue. Where I can take full responsibility because there were system problems in the department. At least that I was aware of. The second issue that I really am finding it very difficult to deal with the public protector's office on is where we, as the department, have internal processes
that are consistent with the Public Service Act and the Public Service Regulation around the conduct of some of our employees, who after a process of termination as a result of those problems, they then go to the Office of the Public Protector. And the Public Protector make a finding against us as a department of maladministration on labor matters and demand reinstatement of those employees. Right? Okay. That is not just the only thing she demands. She also demands that we back pay people who had gone AWOL. Not for 1 month, not for 2 months, not for 5 months, for at least over a year, if not two. And we spend the entire time chasing our tail, trying to explain that because, in my personal view, in spite of the written representations we make, she had already figured a conclusion, a determination. She nonetheless issues an order of maladministration against the department. Thirdly, issue around witness protection, we were not informed of this issue. It came to us as a resolution that had already been negotiated, not with my knowledge, but nonetheless we obliged in the witness protection environment. And we did what the Public Protector ordered us to do. Other issue, and this is the last one, the amendment, this is the last one that I feel really, very strongly about. Issues that clearly officials are forum shopping. They are at the bargaining chamber, they are at the Public Service Commission, and then if they don't win in all of these, they go to the Public Protector, they succeed with her recommendation. Again, negotiated at entry level of the department, these are then decisions that she says they are settlement agreements, and my understanding is that a settlement agreement, there must be an offer, and there must be a recipient, in other words, offer and acceptance. The agreements are not signed, but she nonetheless wishes to implement it. I do not necessarily take personal issue with the Public Protector, because in some of her findings, she has been found to be correct. And I know that we have been errant in some areas, but I do take serious offense when there are findings that are made against the department, which findings I believe run contrary to the broader legislation that governs us. I do respect the fact that the Public Protector is an entity that is created in terms of the Constitution. But I do not appreciate the fact that all the time when the findings are being made and we challenge the content of those findings, we are being waived by the provisions of the Constitution. I really do not appreciate that. So my view is, as I conclude, that to the extent that the Public Protector writes to me and texts each other, incidentally, contrary to public opinion, which is popular at this stage, that we are not responding to any of the things that she is saying. To the extent that she says there's an issue, occasionally she calls me, I text her back, she texts me, we don't agree, or sometimes we agree, and we resolve the issue when we've agreed. But to then go and report as if there's nothing that we are doing, I think it's disingenuous. And that's where I need to conclude. Now, but going forward, I have committed myself to the minister, because we remember that the deputy minister is a delegated authority in terms of the arrangements between the minister and the deputy minister. That the deputy minister looks after all issues that emanate from offices of Chapter 9 institutions. He meets with them regularly. He raises some of these issues with me. I respond to them. We try and grow them at that level. Now, the Public Protector, therefore, has many opportunities. If she has written to me and I have not responded, she still has an opportunity to meet the Deputy Minister, raise the issues there, and then only if the Deputy Minister does not deal with the issues, can she take the issue to the Minister and probably then bring them to Parliament. This is what is happening. Those opportunities are there. I then write to the Public Protector. And instead of her responding to me, she then goes to the minister to raise whatever it is that she's unhappy about in my responses. Now, that I find problematic. We all have certain responsibilities, and I appreciate hers, but I certainly would be very happy if she would appreciate mine. And that's all I wish to say on the matter. Thank you. Oh, sorry. As far as I'm not having included these issues in the annual report, I really would wish to say that going forward we'll include them. But generally what we tend to include in the annual report is one we would have put in as a strategic objective and how we have performed against those. So generally there are things that we do not, in fact we do not include everything that we do in the department in the annual report. But going forward, we agree. We will start including, and perhaps I would ask my colleague Lohang to ensure that we also include it in our quarterly report, not just the public protector, but all chapter 9 institutions. And whilst I'm at it, I might want to just say very briefly that the Human Rights Commission has also raised a number of issues around appeals and all of those issues, which we will deal with tomorrow. But those issues have also been taken to the public protector. So we are dealing with them from the Human Rights Commission. We are also dealing with the same issues from the public protector side. I certainly would, this would be part of the report that we will cover when we respond to the progress and the implementation of the issues that arose in the DJP self-outing letter. We will deal with that now. Thank you.
I mean, obviously there's some matters of concern there, but what I would like to know is, have you considered taking, I mean, if it's a case that's clearly outside of mandate, like it sounds like it will be the case with labour disputes. I mean, you have a remedy taken on review to the court, and perhaps you should look at doing that in one or two of the matters, just so that you can establish the boundaries, because there's nothing wrong with that. Then it becomes where the public sector makes a finding and the department just ignores it. I don't think that's really a constructive way to do it. But if you think it's really wrong, I mean, have you considered that?
On that point, I mean, the difficulty is that the Constitution is a bit unclear. They give her the power to take remedial action. And it's meant to be... has the power regulated by national legislation to take appropriate remedial action. Now, her interpretation of that is that she can do what she likes. But quite clearly, she can recommend the cancelling of contracts, but only a court can cancel them. She can, so my understanding as well is it's not binding. You do need to say, yes, we agree, no, we don't agree. If you don't agree, you don't implement. It's a pity that you didn't give us this information before she came, because one of the issues when she was here was, is she doing too much? And she was assuring us in areas that she shouldn't be involved in, and she was assuring us that wasn't the case. But if she's involved in labor disputes, I mean, that's not correct. It is a whole Labor Relations Act process going as far as Labor Appeal Court and the SEA and the Constitutional Court. And once, you know, that's the route you must follow, because both parties, so you can't have a settlement agreement or have the department bound. But I think, Chair, it would be useful, I mean, one of the problems, and Chair, I'm very unhappy that we specifically said the department, I mean, the Master's Office was mentioned. We specifically said to her when she came on Friday, the department and the Master, including the Master's Office, we're going to be here from Tuesday. Give us what your recommendations are and your complaints are by Monday morning. It's now Wednesday. Did you change it to Tuesday? But anyway, it's still a day later. And I think it would be useful if the DD maybe would sit down, obviously with more time and thought, these problems, because yes, if the communication is not with the DD but some more junior official, then how can the department be, how can a complaint be made that the department is not responding? As far as the issue of the complaints, it was specifically the ones where there were written reports. So she investigates hundreds and deals with hundreds. but she only produces a few written reports annually, and I think the number has gone down. I can't remember the figure. I think it was about 40-something in total, and the 1 year, I think the previous one, 14 is the next or whatever. So it's only those, really. And the one, though, was this one on the TRC, which when we asked her, why were you investigating, she then claimed, no, it's been outstanding since 2008 or 9, and the department hadn't responded, so that's why she's done it. But, Chair, I think that in our report, we need to hone in on this thing. I mean, we can maximize the effectiveness of the Public Protector's Office if it is properly put out what the problems are with the different government departments. That information is given to the National Assembly, to whom she reports, and then the relevant committees can take those issues up with the department, because all we see at the moment is a graph which says 700 or something complaints involving justice, which could be anything from the Guardian's Fund to legal aid, and we have no clue what those are actually about.
Well, I think I'm going to draft a letter to her. Mr. Jeffrey is right, DG. We had expected something from her, and we had said by Tuesday. I don't know whether the events of Friday and then the weekend were of such a nature that it's probably... Christine is shaking her head. It might be such that now they've sort of forgotten about it. I'm going to ask for all full detailed report on all issues the office dealt with relating to the department and then to the master's office. Because those were the two that we were particularly interested in. And we said, look, what you've got there doesn't help us. Because the department we are directly responsible for is oversight. And it would help us if we knew what are you talking about. And similarly with the master. That's why the members that they keep saying, when are we dealing with masters? Friday, okay. And I'm going to do that. DG, we hear what you say. All right. And for now, I'm not going to add to what DG has said. I'm going to hold fire. But, you know, if you wish to comment and add, don't let it stop you. Yes.
What's beyond binding? I do think the Public Protector has a certain status. I don't think it's advisable for a government department to just ignore. And I think if you're going to report in your report, and it is useful to say what has been done, what has come to your office, what has been the finding, what is your attitude towards the finding, perhaps all. And I do think that there is a potential case for a review to the court. Because even though it's not binding unless the court enforces it, it doesn't enforce the status of the Public Protector for a department to keep on saying we don't agree with you. And if you really believe it's outside her mandate, I think it may well be useful to actually take it. If it's something that you feel really, really strongly about, that you think it's completely wrong,
I mean, what was interesting was the Human Rights Commission told us that, I can't remember how many, but some of their matters are taken on review. And now their matters are also not binding. So you can make a finding that toilets must be supplied in a particular area, but you've actually got to go to the Equality Court to get that enforced. But if people take them on review, the one crucial difference between the Human Rights Commission and the Public Protector is that the Human Rights Commission is involving both the public and the private sector. And I would imagine it's the private sector that's taking them on review. The Public Protector is only making findings against the state by definition in terms of the Constitution. And maybe the state is being too nice.
Well, I hear what Ms. Schaefer is saying, and perhaps you need to think about that, although I wonder about the cost. You see, when you're dealing with labor matters, my little knowledge of it is that they are internal processes, you know, and even the courts recognize you should exhaust those. And only when you've exhausted those, then you start moving into the realm of CCM bargaining chamber, CCMA, and then possibly the Labor Courts. So, but, you know, we're speculating now, and I have to wait and see what she presents like.
Do you want to do in maybe also in the report, so that you don't have the perception that they are just being ignored? They just say, this is a funny, but in terms of our legal, internal legal opinion or something, this is called in this action should be dealt with like that, therefore we aren't going to do it. Maybe that's another option if you don't want to do the court read. But, I mean, I would just caution against just ignoring it and saying we don't agree.
We had a long engagement with her on this issue. She was of the view that the findings were tantamount to, yes, final and binding. And I know Mr. Jeffrey, I try to be neutral, and Mr. Jeffrey meant to know, you're not. The courts are the final arbiters of all disputes. That's in the Constitution. And so yours can't be final and binding. If Mr. Brian Munchie is found to have done malice in this issue and he chooses to challenge that finding by the public protector, he can go to court. So where's the final and binding? It doesn't. It's the court. And that whole process. But, all right, you've sort of, in a funny way, I'm actually sorry we didn't get this before we met. No, but, all right, we're not blaming you, DG. You want to?
I'm not now responding to this issue specifically, but I'm just responding to the generalities of issues that that are being managed elsewhere as well. And I just wanted to share with Parliament because it may very well be that Parliament has not been informed of this. In my favorite... That forum. In the forum of South African Directors General, one of the things that we were not monitoring before, that we are monitoring, and if you wrote to the president, they would probably also give an independent account of what I'm saying, is that we are now monitoring our response as government to Chapter 9 institutions, and we report to the presidency on that, and every now and again the presidency will then take a total report and take it to cabinet, including our issues relating to compliance with international obligations. Now, the Human Rights Commission complaints against us as the Department of Justice has been the delays in how long it takes us to realize the international obligations in terms of the United Nations. Now, we are doing that, and we are being monitored by the presidency on that. Similarly, the public protector, similarly, the Public Service Commission, and all the wonderful bodies that exist. Now, all I'm saying is that it's not just that we would be indifferent to the public protector alone. There are these other processes that have been introduced just to ensure that government departments do play their part in assisting Chapter 9 to do their work. And I really just wanted to share this just as additional information. And just to say again, just as a closing remark on specifically the public protector, that in the cases that I have articulated, except for the cases where it's labor relations, we have accepted the recommendations. We have implemented her recommendations to the point of implementing the remedial actions. I had indicated the witness protection case. I will write it down, but I had also indicated that case of the rape of a minor, which has been reported on. It's not true entirely that we just ignored her findings. Maybe on the TRC one, because I was asking Dr. De Villiers, and he if I missed the letter, said the team that must deal with the thing would have seen the letter, and they ought to have acted on it, and he was looking blank. So we'll find that, and we'll put it in our report to Parliament. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I like the closing remarks. That actually demonstrates that you're not completely just ignoring the Office of the Public Protector's recommendations, which is good. And I think you actually have the right as a department to challenge the findings if you're not happy with anything. And I think what is very important is for us to engage with the support of the public for care purposes. Let's get all the information and engage with the office. So, and this is to us closer.
I won't be long, but just to clarify, I the public protector didn't say, and I don't think members were meant to convey that justice wasn't responding at all. It was an issue of specifically on that TRC one. The reason she started the investigation was because there was no response. That was the point made, rather than justice is not responding. And I think she came on the day that the announcement was made, or the day after the announcement was made about the minister's payment for this rape victim. But my worry then is, in terms of what the DG has said, that you have accepted all the recommendations bar the labour matters. If one takes the rape issue was, Chair, my understanding, I haven't read the report, but from the media it was a person who had a rape victim who had experienced excessive delays in the justice system. And the public protector recommended that she be paid compensation, and presumably she named an amount. Now, if it were a civil suit, there would first be the issue of liability, and once the issue of liability is resolved, then it would be the issue of the quantum, the amount of the damages. And in deciding on the quantum, both parties would be able to make input and be able to argue. I don't know if the quantum in this case, whether the department made any input. I don't know the basis that the public protector arrived at the figure, or whether it was a thumbsuck. So I'm quite worried. I would hope that the department does not blindly implement recommendations or decisions from the public protector. I would hope that the department does its own evaluation, and that they do not feel that they have to implement. Because, I mean, my understanding of the public protector, and it is, as far as I understand, same situation with other ombudsmen internationally, is that they're basically a quick, expeditious look at something, a finding which can then be put into the domain of public opinion, but they are not enforceable. And they're not enforceable because in order to be quick and come up with a response quickly, they have to cut corners. And those corners are things like the normal process in defining the amount of damages would be quite an extensive investigation and a process involving the party that's going to have to pay. So I hope the DG is not blindly implementing the recommendations of the public protector.
Yes, I just want to articulate only the principle, and I won't go into the details. The principle is this. It is precisely the reason that the Honourable Member is raising that we do not follow those recommendations blindly. And it is through some kind of an engagement process between ourselves and the public protector. And that's where sometimes the breakdown happens, because they have a view and we have a view and that we can't find each other. But also there are some areas where compensation is not, call it, an appropriate term to use under certain circumstances. And that is why we went the route we did, because if this was a court litigation process, we would have had to adopt a payment into court of what we believed was right, and then let the other party challenge that payment into court. So in one of the matters, we did it that way, and then in the other matter, we negotiated down what she had proposed, but we also felt a certain level of responsibility, and we felt, look, if this helps us to get out of the situation, we will do it. So, but we will provide the written information on that. Thank you very much. And insofar as paying blindly, I like money too much to just give it away.